Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
With the first one, I was like, oh boy, you're going to have a fun second one. He didn't feel terrible. He just had a fever.
We're on. Morning. It is Wednesday. It is the last Wednesday of 2020. A year unlike anything we've ever seen before. And nobody probably wants to see anything like it again. Things would be sort of looking up for us. We've dropped down in numbers being reported by our local EOC. Hospitalizations are down. New cases are way down. And deaths, thankfully, haven't seen an increase in the last week. But we've only got roughly 6.5% of our population, 1 in 15, who may have already had the virus. We're still months away from a vaccine being available community-wide, and we're still all kind of crossing our fingers for the Christmas spike and then moving into what our leaders are now predicting to be the worst months that are ahead of us. So, again, thank you for tuning in this morning for another Doc of the Rock. We have a lot to talk about. And, again, our thanks to our local medical practitioners who have tirelessly kept showing up week after week to talk about some of the issues we keep facing as a community. And, again, this is your opportunity to get your questions answered. These folks are professionals. They're here specifically to answer your questions. And if you have some, you may as well go to somebody who might actually know a valuable answer to what you're asking. So shoot us an email, lowdown@kmxt.org, or call 486-3181, and we'll gladly pass the question along to one of the members of the panel today, who are Dr. Evan Jones from CANA and Dr. Shanna Theobald from the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic again. It is so nice to see you folks. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks. Good to see you, and Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah. How was the week for you?
Oh, pretty normal Christmas for me, because our family kind of just stays together as a family, around Christmas time. And my boys came back from college a couple weeks ago. And so it's been nice to have them down from Fairbanks and so to have the whole family together. To be honest, we don't even go out that much and socialize that much. We usually go out in the boat and do things like that. So didn't have to change too much.
So what kind of navigation issues did you have to deal with in regards to transporting people from out of town?
So had the boys, they kind of quarantined before coming down and then got tested when they got down here so we could hit the ground running. And so they're coming from Fairbanks also, so it's probably safer in Fairbanks than Kodiak lately. And frankly, everybody in the family got tested when they got here to make sure I didn't give it to them and they didn't give it to me, and just trying to be safe with that.
So have things been busy in the medical community in the last couple of weeks? Have they slowed down a little bit? I mean, when you see the numbers go down, you sort of assume that maybe things aren't as crazy as they were a couple of weeks ago.
I think there's a natural bouncing around. I've been very busy in clinic. And I just happened to look up at the hospital census a couple of days ago, and it was 17, which is high for Kodiak. Certainly not all COVID. But it just kind of randomly bumps up and down. It is interesting. There was times where we're down to zero in the hospital. And one time I was up there and I discharged the patient and I noticed there's zero on the floor and zero in the ER. And that almost never happens. But then we have times where there's 17, and it gets little busy with or without COVID sometimes.
Are we seeing a decrease in people coming in for regular services? Or has that rebounded somewhat? I know people were very fearful of going in and doing regular things, and then there was all a limitation because of our numbers went up on what kind of things people were going to be allowed to go in and do. So now, do you have regular clinic again? Are people coming in to do the regular medical tests and procedures that they need?
Shannon can talk about her clinic, but our clinic is still largely, we try to put everything online. Frankly, some of the biggest difficulties have been trying to get testing done at the hospital because they're still somewhat shut down except for emergencies. We can get things done, but it needs to be something that's a high priority. And so things like ultrasounds that I need to have done are kind of sitting on the back burner until this gets a little bit better. I do look at even admissions at the hospital. It has changed the way we practice medicine at the hospital. Patients that we would normally like to bring in overnight and just observe them and make sure they're doing okay, we've typically not been if they have a reasonably safe home environment because of the danger of being up there with, you know, five or six COVID patients and contracting COVID while in the hospital. So it has changed our practice a little bit. We're still trying to be as safe as possible, but sometimes safe means sending a patient home that we would not normally send home. The nurses up the hospital are amazing and try to keep it as separated out as possible, but I think we're trying to be as safe as possible at the same time.
And that's your ambulatory care clinic?
Yeah, I think our numbers were definitely down as far as people coming in, higher volume of telemedicine calls, and the testing numbers were the biggest thing that we noticed have kind of gone down as we've had fewer and fewer cases and, you know, contacts and exposures in the last week to 2 weeks. But I think part of that was the holidays, and I think that in the next few weeks we'll probably see a kind of, you know, the clinic filling back up again, or at least appointments filling back up again, whether they're telemedicine or inpatient visits.
So these are tests that you normally order are going down, or the kind of where people come in and want a test on their own?
Both. Yeah. Most of them are contacts of positive cases. The tests we were doing 60 to 90 tests a day, which for our small clinic, and you know, we have two nurses on, and at some points we had no nurses because we did have a few people ended up getting COVID in our clinic, so it was pretty sparse staff with high volumes of testing. And it seems like those numbers have gone down a lot, and the number of positives that we're getting every day have gone down, which is a big relief. And I think a lot of that is due, I want to give credit to the Emergency Operations Center in Kodiak again for, you know, mandating some of those mitigation efforts, because I think that made a really big difference in Kodiak's numbers.
The first question of the day from a listener is on that topic. You know, has the number of people being tested gone down, and is that an indication of why our numbers are down? I mean, I think there's a concern there of if people aren't getting tested, are there a lot of people out in the community who actually have the virus and we just don't know about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our percent of positive numbers has gone down. So the percent of positive tests is what really tells you kind of where you're at in the community. And I don't know the highest, Dr. Jones, you might know how high we were at. I think it was around 10% or something when we were kind of at our peak, where 1 in 10 tests was a positive, and now we're down to maybe a handful of percent. I don't want to say numbers because I don't know the exact numbers, but that has decreased as well.
I did notice on a statewide basis that we just went below 5% again. I don't know what the local number is, though.
I think in our clinic, when I've been there, it's been maybe, you know, 1 or 2, 3 positive tests out of 20 to 30 that we're doing now. So closer to Wait, that's like 10%, isn't it? I was going to say. we were still up there last time I was doing testing, but it was significantly decreasing. We were getting 6 to 12 positive tests a day, and then we were down to one or two with not as much of a decrease in people coming in to get tested.
Well, to this mythical herd immunity, to get to that point, you know, we're nowhere even close to that. I mean, we need the vaccine to be moved throughout most of the people in the community, because you surely don't want to see the virus go through and infect. Well, if the numbers are correct and we're only a little less than 7% of our population has been infected already, and we have to get to 80%, 85% for herd immunity, that's a kind of a long stretch. And if the numbers stayed the same, you know, you probably see some significant things happening.
It's a tough mark to meet, but we don't really know what the mark is. Dr. Fauci kind of proposed, he freely admitted that he's kind of been moving the herd immunity percentage mark. And he says, if I were to guess, I think it's close to 90%. He's a pretty smart guy. I don't know what it will be in the end, but every person who gets vaccinated cuts down one more transmission or one transmission link and breaks down the disease process a little bit more. As a society, how many people have to be immune to it? Who knows? I mean, it's the difficult part about this disease is that it is easy to give to other people. And now we're coming out with strains that are even easier to give to other people. And so, you know, we may reach the point where, well, really, it's not 90, it's 95%. I have no idea. It could settle out at 80% need to be immunized. I don't know. We kind of look along smallpox numbers, which is even more transmissible than this. And it had to be at 90, 95% to stop the transmission of smallpox. Certainly a much more deadly disease. But it's one that required about 90% immunity or immunization.
Well, you opened the door there to the variant. So let's talk a little bit about the variant. Now, you know, the fear was that it was going to get out of the UK, of course. It surely seemed like there was other strains of this floating around America for a while, but now they've actually locked it down in Colorado somehow and said that they're the highly transmissible version of this COVID is in Colorado, and now they're looking in LA and somehow doing tests there to see whether or not it's got into LA. It's really not very surprising, though, as fast as this thing moves, that it sure seems like it would be throughout the community. But what kind of concerns do we have about the highly transmissible version and whether or not this vaccine that we're rolling out, or the three different vaccines, is going to be effective on the different mutations that we're going to see?
As of right now, these mutations are not large enough to sneak around the vaccine. They're pretty small variations. As far as we can tell, the tougher part is the more transmissible disease it is, the higher the percentage of herd immunity you need. If it's a highly transmissible disease, well, the needed herd immunity goes up and up and up. And unfortunately, you know, Fauci's already saying we're at 90%. Well, if the transmissibility is even easier than we thought, well, that number may creep up even more. I don't know what it will be. That's kind of outside my realm of expertise, but that's the biggest issue to me. Doesn't seem like the severity of the disease is any worse. Seems like it does fine with this vaccine. The biggest thing that I would point out is, as this year goes on, I guarantee that there are hundreds of mutations out there. This is not a single virus. There are hundreds of different mutations out there. with our DNA, we have all kinds of correction mechanisms to make sure errors don't occur. And frankly, errors are pretty rare in human DNA because we have so many correction mechanisms within our cells so that the errors get rooted out. With a virus, it does not have that. It doesn't have the correction mechanism, so it's constantly mutating. And the mutations that get it passed around faster amplify very quickly, and the mutations that make it worse just die out. And so it is, the change is rapid with a virus as compared to humans.
Some cheery. Go ahead. I was just going to make a snarky comment, but so I'll pass it on to you before I do.
That's great. One thing about the variants too is that the U.S. is not genotyping as much of the virus, period, compared to other countries. There's a database that, you know, each country is kind of putting their genetic variant, all of their genotyping of the virus into. And the U.S., I think in the last week, did 37, and the U.K. did 3,700. South Africa did several, you know, a few thousand. And that's how they found the variant that's causing increased transmissibility in the U.K. And they do suspect it's 40 to 70% more contagious than, you know, the prior kind of standard strain that was around in the UK at that time. So it probably is out of the bag in the US, and we're about to see what's going to happen next. As far as the severity, most of the cases were caught in the beginning of December. And so I think it will take time to really see how it's going to play out for as far as severity goes. And yeah, like Dr. Jones said, the concern is that, you know, will the vaccine continue to be effective as the virus mutates into different strains? Will the testing pick up because it, you know, it kind of picks up part of the genetic code. Will that still be caught on testing? And then exactly the severity and the contagiousness are kind of the four big questions as variants develop. And that all is yet to be seen how it's going to play out. And so I feel like the whole pandemic is like this carrot in front of our eyes. We keep on thinking, okay, we're almost, you know, to a vaccine, we're getting testing, we're hopefully getting through this as a community, and we kind of keep moving those end markers.
Well, it does get a bit bleak when you hear that, you know, we've been plodding along and locking things down and being careful about what we're doing for months and months, and now they're talking about us going into the worst months are ahead of us. You know, how much
going on complete lockdown.
I mean, from the information that you get about this person that tested for the new variant in Colorado, was not a traveler and, you know, had limited contacts with people. So you kind of wonder how you even got that particular version of it, you know? So I think it just makes it more crucial for us to keep doing what we're doing to try and maintain our sanity until this vaccine arrives.
So, definitely.
I have a question for both of you that I don't know if I ever asked, but are you actually treating COVID patients in the clinics?
Go ahead.
Okay. I actually don't bring them into the clinic. I have gone out to the parking lot because I don't want to walk through the clinic. And so I've had them stay in their car, put on my PPE, go out, examine them, talk to them, if necessary. There has to be a compelling reason for me to go out there. If it's talking about symptoms, I don't need to see them in person. The big thing is we do try to send people home who have severe symptoms with an oximeter so they can monitor their oxygen levels, and we talk about what to look for. And there's some people I'm in daily contact with when they're doing poorly, and we have daily phone visits with them, and that's usually been adequate. I've only done two or three parking lot visits. The vast majority have been by phone or VTC. Yesterday, I did two or three VTC or telephone consults, and no one in or even outside the clinic.
Same.
Yeah, we're following. Yeah, similar practices. If someone's really sick and we need to kind of, they don't have a pulse oximeter, we didn't have enough to give out to all the patients. We have had them come through a separate entrance and stay kind of in an isolated room, essentially, in a different part of the clinic. We have three entrances into our clinic, so that helps. But we really are trying to minimize, you know, start off by phone call, and then only if we think we need to listen to their lungs, or potentially, you know, they might have low oxygen saturation or vital signs that would make it needed to go into the ER. Other than that, we've been just treating them over the, you know, talking over the phone, same kind of practice.
So pretty much the hospital then is taking the brunt of people with the most severe symptoms. I mean, for the most part, if somebody has COVID, they're pretty much on their own. They may have some backup consultation on a daily basis, but pretty much there's not much you can do for them, is there, other than send them to the hospital if things get really bad?
Yeah, so the instructions I've been giving is, you know, I send them home with an oximeter, and I let them know if your oxygen's getting low, below 88%, and it's just not coming up again, no matter what you do, you should go to the ER, because you're probably going to need supplemental oxygen at that point. We talk about laying on your belly. That seems to help clear out lungs, especially in severe patients. But I've been doing it in my less severe patients who are doing it at home, who are just like, man, my lungs get tight. And I'd say, well, just spend as much time as you can on your belly. Maybe it's psychological, but it seems to be working pretty well. That's what we do in the hospital with patients whose breathing is getting more and more difficult. And so there are some things that I advise for patients when they are at home. We've been, a few of us here at Canna, we've been discussing, should we be saying start taking a baby aspirin every day if you get this, because so many clotting issues that occur with this disease, and we're somewhat up in the air on a lot of these things, and there eventually we may find that there's a role for steroids for even people at home. I did talk to an infectious disease doc, and he recommended not using them unless they're frankly intubated. It's going to take us probably years to really come out with a really good, concise treatment for this that we know works and we know is scientifically backed. And that's where we've run into a lot of things that are exciting at first. And then when we really study it in a rigorous way, we find that it really doesn't do much. It's going to be, we discussed it before, but when we first started doing this radio show, so much of the information we gave was misinformation, because we were still learning about it. And I guarantee so much of the things we think are true today are going to be misinformation. The big thing is I do try to base my opinion on some scientific basis. And unfortunately, there's not a lot to base it on yet, but there will be.
Shannon, when you had to go through the disease yourself, I mean, was there anything that helped you?
Yeah, I was going to kind of echo what Dr. Jones said. The hardest part about viral infections is that supportive care is the main treatment that we have for almost the majority of our viral infections. I mean, you know, they've come up with antivirals for Hep C and HIV, but even those are extremely difficult. You usually have to take multiple courses and there's a lot of resistance. So in most viruses, it really is supportive care, and supportive care includes, you know, rest, hydrate, take your vitamin D, your vitamin C, zinc. Ibuprofen is, from all the studies, you know, in the beginning, there was kind of a question if ibuprofen increased or worsened basically the outcome. And those studies have been relooked at, and more patients taking ibuprofen have been looked at. It does appear to be safe, and it does really help with body aches, the headache, just kind of taking the edge off of the discomfort from the virus, as in most, you know, flu and cold viruses. Tylenol can help too with a fever. I know a lot of people are taking just like cool showers when they were getting the fevers. If you need something for like a Sudafed for decongestant, you know, some of kind of our normal, you know, decongestant cold and cough flu medicines help a little bit with the symptoms. But a lot of times with a cough, you want to clear out whatever your body's trying to cough out. You want to get that coughed up and spit out, cleared out, so that whatever viral load is in that is kind of removed from your system. But really, unfortunately, it does. I mean, ginger tea, honey, lemon tea, all those kind of like old home remedies are kind of therapeutic and helpful, but really there's not a lot of medication that we have at our disposal that we know works and is safe.
Even some of the medications we do use are possibly helpful, but not remarkable at this point.
Well, you got a chance to listen in, I guess, last week when we were talking about the progress with this fluvoxamine and ivermectin. Is there anything that you would like to add to the conversation, even?
Yeah, I just totally agree with Shan on this, that I am more of a, I don't want to say cowboy, but I would be willing to try some of these things like ivermectin to a certain extent, but I'd way rather see some studies be done on it. I watched the video that a lot of people have watched about the doc. I think he's from Michigan or somewhere like that. He's an intensivist. To me, his word brings more credence than the standalone clinic where a doctor has the answer for this disease and he's treated 100 people and all of them have survived. Yeah, you expect if a patient is good enough to drive up to your clinic that he should survive. So that doesn't give me a lot of credence. This is a guy who works in the hospital and he seems very sincere. He may still be wrong, but I think it bears looking at his numbers and it bears studying a little bit because may have stumbled on something that does work well. We were all excited about hydroxychloroquine early on and how it interacts with the ACE2 receptors and keeps the virus from attaching to cells so it can't replicate into cells. And I'd read up on it, and then you find out that it's probably causing more death than it's helping. Even with that one, does it bear continued study? Yeah, I do think it bears looking at again. It is the tough part really is that trying to come up with the money for all these studies because they're complex to do correctly. And so it is a difficult thing to do. And so we'll continue to work with these things, but I think some of these things may not be proven until years later.
Okay. Got a couple of questions from folks. Let's move into those before we go into vaccines a little bit. Should travelers who had COVID in mid-November and are returning to the island after having been gone a month be tested? Travelers had COVID in mid-November and are coming back to the island after being gone a month. Should they be tested?
That's a good question. I don't think there's any, at this point, data or recommendations to support retesting a month later or 2 months late. Let's say it's almost 2 months by the time they come back without, necessarily symptoms. They might still, a month later is kind of 28 days or actually a little bit longer is when we've still seen the tests come back positive, and it's because they're shedding virus that is dead, inactive, but still picking up the genetic material. So there is a kind of risk of it being positive, but not truly positive. And then hopefully that has conferred some immunity. 90 days is the recommendation for the CDC as far as, from the time of infection to hopefully having that sustained immunity. 90 days is the window that is kind of the average at this point. But we have talked about, the studies that show reinfections as early as 38 days and as late as 9 months later. So it's in that window of time where I think a repeat test would not necessarily be indicated, but I don't have the true recommendation on that. I don't know. Dr. Jones, do you have a better input?
I mean, if somebody was positive in November, I don't know if you remember early on, we were talking about where this virus is detected. Well, it was detected on this surface. 24 hours after it had been put there. It was detected here 48 hours. Well, I mean, it's really looking for little protein particles, little bits of the virus. It doesn't mean it is an active functional virus. And so when we use these machines, it's looking for chunks of the virus, which may be in your body. And there may be indeed be some real virus in your body, but not enough to infect other people. There's been people who continue to test positive on these machines over 100 days after infection. And it's not a reinfection. They kind of were continuing to test them through. And so retesting them is a tough deal. Yep, I know people get reinfected, like we're talking about. I don't know what the dude was doing who got reinfected 38 days after, but he needs to change his life a little bit and do something different. But most people, I think, are going to have immunity for quite a while afterwards. What that number really is, I have no idea. We've talked about your antibodies go down, and a lot of people have undetectable antibodies after 3 or 4 months. But we still don't know how much immunity do T cells confer, and they seem to have pretty a longer memory than the antibodies in our bodies. So we're still working it out. I wouldn't be excited about getting retested if I had it in November personally.
Interesting question, though. You need to change your lifestyle a little bit. I mean, for somebody who has already had COVID, you know, is there the shield around that person? Do they then not have to do the same, wear the mask and wash your hands and stay distant from other people? Do you get 3 months grace period?
Hopefully it does confer a shield of protective immunity around. At the same time, we've been telling people, you know, continue wearing your mask, continue washing your hands, because there are, you know, those new variants out that you might get reinfected with and pass that on to somebody else. If your body is, you know, if the virus is around and you're fighting it off, but still shedding viral particles. We don't have very much information about exactly, you know, what happens when after an infection. But I know a lot of countries like Iceland, for example, is allowing people to travel into Iceland if they can prove, you know, a certificate that they had the virus, the infection already, and probably soon the vaccine will be, you know, one of those criteria for traveling to other countries. There's still so much we don't know.
Yeah, well, there's the question of the variant, too. I mean, if you get infected with COVID-1, is it possible you can get COVID-4?
Eventually. Right now, they're similar enough that I think your body's going to recognize it as similar enough. It's just like we look at people. Everybody looks a little bit different, but we can see, he's got a head, two arms, two legs. We say he's a human. But once in a while, we look around and see that and realize, that one's actually a monkey. It has two arms and two legs and a head, but that one's a monkey. But we're pretty good at identifying humans, even though we look very different from one another, from person to person. And our body's that way, too, that there are some variants among these viruses, but it's pretty good at identifying, hey, this is actually, it looks a little different, but this virus is the same issue that I had before, and I'm going to fight it off. The tough part is when it disguises itself really well, and there's enough difference that it can sneak by and just like the common cold or different types of influenza, it likely will mutate eventually to the point where we need to keep updating this immunization a little bit.
So the follow-up to that question was, should they still quarantine, and for how long? So if somebody already had it a couple of months ago and they travel here, when they get here, are they required to quarantine again?
You take that one, Shanna. That's,
I think the true answer is, you know, we're not exactly sure what that all means. But as for the information we have so far, there's no recommendation about quarantining. I know a lot of like some of my friends in Cordova that had COVID have like basically that 90-day period, you know, their kids can go to school, they can interact in the community. And then at that 90-day period, they kind of have to re-go back to the initial rules again of the quarantining, the travel, the testing rules, because at that point, we just don't know. I think we're still in a gray zone, you know, even up to 90 days and then after 90 days. I don't, as far as everything I've read, there are no guidelines saying that they would need to quarantine. They essentially could probably be considered to have immunity for at least that 90-day period and treat it as if, you know, they got the vaccine. But I, to be completely honest, I'm not 100% sure exactly what the recommendation should be or will be in the future around that.
I hate to say it, but I know I would have a tough time quarantining if I had the virus a month ago and traveled and I was done with it. I'd feel like it was a profound waste of my time to quarantine again. The CDC may strongly disagree with me in the future, but they are smarter than me on a lot of this stuff. But I think you have some immunity. It does give you a pass on a lot of things. Eventually, we do need life to start getting back to normal in some way. And I think sometimes normal life has a risk with it. And there is some risk with it. Let's not take foolish risks, but eventually we are going to have to start working back to life the way I feel like it's meant to be.
You know, we do have kind of a loophole in this whole system, though, because for a while there, weren't you just, when somebody had symptoms, you were assuming that people had COVID, right? At one time, it seemed like we were testing everybody. And then all of a sudden it was, well, there's no real need to test you for COVID now because we're just going to assume you have it. Go home, and if your symptoms get worse, go to the hospital. But there's not actually a test out provision, right? So if somebody went through the symptoms and thought that they had COVID, but well, you didn't really have COVID without a test to know that they did have it, then you're sending them off into a situation where they're gonna make themselves put themselves in a situation where they might really get it this time. I mean, we keep hearing about, well, there is no flu season this year, but do we really know that there is no flu season?
So in Kodiak, we do have a little bit of a great system because most people who have had symptoms have gotten tested. Other places haven't had that luxury, and it is a bit of a luxury.
Yeah, my husband didn't get tested. He doesn't have confirmation of positive case, but because we were exposed together, I was positive. We had very similar, we had kind of overlapping symptoms. He had a few different ones, and I didn't. I had different ones, and he did, but, you know, the bulk of them were the same. Public health said consider him positive. I don't know if he ever counted into Kodiak's numbers, and I don't know, you know, what he would need to do to prove that he had it. I mean, I think writing up, you know, the letter and having public health say that he was presumed positive, but I agree. It is tricky because there are probably a lot of people in the United States, and I agree, more than Kodiak, but some in Kodiak for sure, that didn't necessarily get that test. I think this is where the antibody test, once we have better data on how accurate it is, will come in handy. I know, me and some of the other people who I know have had COVID positive have gotten the antibody test at our clinic just to see. And I do have the IgG and IgM antibodies, COVID-19 specific antibodies. So I think it would be a useful test to prove some kind of immunity in the future. But at this point, it's all, you know, it hasn't been studied well enough to make a very solid recommendation about whether to use it for proving infection or not.
Well, I know months ago we were pretty excited that you got the antibody test, and there was a lot of hope that this was going to be part of the solution in the long term, but it hasn't been used as much as you thought it was going to be used, or is it still too early in the game?
I think it's still too early in the game. We were using it when a lot of people early on, you know, in the spring and summer were saying, oh, I had the worst viral or worst infection of my life. I'm sure I had COVID. We would do the antibody test and it was negative. And we only had a few cases at that point that we knew for sure had confirmed COVID infection, and those ones were positive. What I think would be really interesting is to get more of our own clinic data. So far, everybody who had had a confirmed positive COVID infection has had a positive antibody test. And for people who, you know, were not sure, we're sending those antibodies out to Quest, where they do a more, sophisticated antibody test of a patient's blood, of their serum. So it will be interesting to have more data. And I think if that test proves to be pretty accurate, it will be a good kind of tool to have in the future to both, you know, confirm how many infections we really had, to give people proof of immunity, so to speak, if they didn't have that test. And then, yeah, for, I mean, in a case of a traveler, it'd be great. In my mind, potentially, it would be great to, for them to be able to get an antibody test and show, yes, I'm still making antibodies to COVID. I should have immunity because I'm producing those antibodies. At this point, though, it's all theoretical, and it will take time to really prove how useful it is.
If somebody gets vaccinated, do they test positive then on the antibody test?
They should. I believe they should have antibodies to it at that point. To be honest, I've not specifically read that. I just assume that they would have antibodies. It'll be interesting to see how long they have the antibodies to, because we're having a double exposure with this vaccine. You get the vaccine, then you get a second dose 3 weeks later. And so I think the hope is that not only will the T cells learn, but the antibodies will learn and have a longer lasting immune response, to having the double vaccine like that.
I'm going to do this follow-up question before I follow up on that. What are the timelines for home testing kits?
I am surprised we don't have them already. I thought we'd have them by Christmas. I thought there would be just like a pregnancy test where you spit in this thing and you put your saliva on a tray and it shows a line that you either have it or don't have it. I know we have the technology at this point. And about a month ago, I'd been reading that it should be out by Christmas, and I just haven't seen it yet. I don't know if Shanna has heard anything different, but I have not personally seen it yet.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it yet either, but I think it will be coming out.
I thought it was, I had heard that it was February, because they had just gotten that approval a couple of weeks ago in Australia, I believe it was. And if I'm right on this, they thought, okay, by the time they make enough of them, there were, if I'm correct, there was only like 3 million of them that were going to be released to the United States, and it was going to take until January or February until they showed up. Why do we need two vaccines? What happens? How do these vaccines work? And what's the difference between the mRNA one and the conventional type vaccine? And why is it that two shots of the mRNA ones are necessary to give you immunity?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Shanna. You grab this. I'll echo when you're done. I have my own take on it.
As you probably have read, after the first vaccine for the Pfizer, it's about 52% effective, and then the second vaccine is closer to 95% effective. And basically what the vaccine is doing is it's introducing the genetic material to create the spike protein of the coronavirus, so that your body basically uses those instructions, makes the spike protein, and then your immune system can recognize that as not part of yourself, your own body, and create antibodies against that spike protein, which is why the vaccine should be effective against all the strains of coronaviruses, because they all, so far as we know, share that same spike protein, which is the way it enters into your cells. But most vaccines are given in a series of 2 to 4 vaccines. The tetanus is a booster that's given every 5 to 10 years, depending on if you are potentially exposed to tetanus or not. And it basically is boosting your body's immune system to kind of fortify that immune response. I don't know if I answered the question explicitly. Help me out, Dr. Jones.
So it does just confer more immunity. It's kind of a reinforcement of the initial vaccine where your body says, oh yeah, this really is a problem. This mRNA, we talked about it a little bit. This is the first time this technology has been applied, but it actually was developed back in 1989, was when the first experiments with mRNA as a possibility for delivering vaccines occurred. And we even look at it's very surprising to me that Pfizer was the first one to get their vaccine approved, because Moderna, the reason that company was created was to start producing mRNA vaccines. And they were looking at rabies and a lot of other things that we potentially could make vaccines to, and even the things like cancer cells and stuff. And so the idea was that we're going to come up with this mRNA structure that will allow us to immunize people in a much more effective way. So even though people are really worried that this is, oh man, this is a brand new vaccine that's never been done before, it's been studied I'm 51 now. It's been studied since I was 20 years old. So it's been studied for 31 years now. And so it's not a new technology. It's the first time we've applied it this way. Some of the biggest breakthroughs have been, how do we sneak this mRNA into the cell itself? Viruses are great at doing this. They sneak their mRNA and they sneak their RNA into our cells and hijack our cells to reproduce viruses pretty easily. It's taken us a while to figure this out. And so we found that putting a really tiny lipid membrane, a fatty membrane around these, kind of protects it as it goes into the cell. But to be really clear, this does not go anywhere near the DNA. People are worried. I even joke about this. I was joking with one of my buddies yesterday. He's like, I said, yeah, I got the vaccine. And he's like, I hope you got spider stuff in your system. You come out a superhero when this is all over. And I joke about that too. But the truth is, it goes nowhere near your DNA. It doesn't go in the nucleus. If you remember back to your high school days, in the middle of your cell, not really the middle, but we'll pretend it's the middle, is the nucleus of the cell. And that's where the DNA is. It never enters there. It's all done in the periphery of the cell. This is really tough for me. I know I have a friend who's going to make fun of me. I think it's in the ribosomes. I'm going back to I think it's in the ribosomes. Does that sound right, Shanna? that the mRNA is replicated. So it's not in the DNA containing areas. It's not going to be inserted into your DNA. It doesn't even get near your DNA. The reason we have not used it up till now is because the biggest developments have been that the mRNA has been really tough to sneak into cells without getting destroyed first. And that's been the biggest development, is putting just a fatty layer on it so it can get into your cell and your body can start producing these spike proteins that your body recognizes as being a foreign invader, and it confers immunity to this disease. Sorry, that was a long-winded way of throwing it out there, but new application, but old technology.
It was great. You had the vaccine. You got that's what I heard in the background.
Yeah, I got it a week ago yesterday, and just I'll do full disclosure and share everything that's happened to myself and all my friends. I had the same experience that I have with a tetanus. My arm was a little sore. That's it. You know how the day after it feels like you had a tetanus shot, it feels like you had a good workout in that arm. That's the only thing that happened to me. One of my good buddies, who's a bit younger, he had that same sore arm experience. He felt fine, but he had a low grade fever the day after. And it didn't slow him down at all, but he did note that he had a temperature of like 100.2. The second one is supposed to be a little tougher to deal with because your body's ready for it now and probably going to have a more rigorous immune response. And so it can have more side effects than the first one. And so when we were figuring out what 3 weeks after the first one is going to be, I had to delay my immunization because I was on call 3 weeks after it was first offered to me. So I delayed my immunization so that I'll be in clinic. And if I'm feeling awful, I'll be able to go home, where when you're on call, it's really tough to get coverage. Clinic, I can reschedule. People in the hospital, they're really bad about rescheduling coming to the hospital. So, so now we'll find out how I do in a couple of weeks.
So you don't have webs coming out of your hands yet?
No, I was really hoping for it and it just didn't happen.
Maybe after the second one.
Yeah, maybe the second one. I'll hold out hope that I'd really prefer the ability to fly, but I'm not sure how I would get that through DNA.
The first patient in the UK got their second vaccine to the 91-year-old lady that used to be a nurse in the UK yesterday. And the third vaccine, the AstraZeneca, is approved in England. And they're going to be rolling that out soon, which is really exciting. And that's a more traditional vaccine, where I think one of the questions was, what's the differences of the vaccines? That's a more traditional one, where it uses an inactive adenovirus, which is a kind of common cold and flu virus. And then it contains some of the coronavirus material, genetic material inside. And then that is a very similar process, but the way that it is kind of gets into the cell is different. And then it has some of those proteins from the coronavirus that your immune system then kind of recognizes again as a foreign invader and not part of yourself, and makes antigens too. And so, and that one is potentially less effective. They had two studies where they gave half the dose and then a full dose, which was about 92% effective. But when they gave two full doses, it was closer to, I think, 50 to 60% effective. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how the different vaccines play out. And the reason why there's so many is because we needed a vaccine and we didn't know which one was going to work. And so it's better to work on multiple vaccines at the same time and have those options and kind of see how they all play out down the line, rather than putting, you know, all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, and potentially having a vaccine that fails. So I think it's a great thing. I think the AstraZeneca one is only $3 or $4, and that one's going to probably be the one that's used most globally because it's affordable in many of the developing countries, and also has that more traditional kind of platform for administering a vaccine. And you only need normal refrigeration temperatures instead of the kind of deep cold freezer that's going to be a barrier in a lot of other countries.
Right. So if you had an option, though, is it unknown at this time? Is there any danger to taking two different vaccines? You know, if you take one that's the 50%er, and then if later on the other ones is available, would there be any problem taking two?
Probably going to have a more vigorous immune response. They even discussed, you know, what if you got the Pfizer for your first one and then accidentally 3 weeks later got the Moderna for your second one? They would still consider you fully immunized, even though they're slightly different, not tremendously, but slightly different. Who knows, maybe someday we'll realize that mixing them is a good thing and confers greater immunity than one company twice. I don't know. But as it stands right now, if you were to get a Moderna at day one and then 3 weeks later get a Pfizer, not recommended, but they still consider you immunized at that point.
As far as safety goes, they all have tremendous safety profile with very few, most of them have no serious reactions. And the ones that we've seen so far with the Pfizer are the allergic reactions, which is probably to the polyethylene glycol is what's suspected at this point, what's causing that allergic response. But as far as, you know, side effects and long-term effects, we don't know yet. We're about 3 months out, but so far there hasn't been shown to be any significant severe side effects.
So it might be a little early, but at some point in time, you're going to have people coming in to see you with questions about whether or not they should take the vaccine. So are you already getting those kind of questions and counseling people? How do you counsel somebody that's reluctant to take the vaccine to take it?
I look at the side effect profile that we know about. In Alaska, we've had two fairly significant allergic reactions, probably more by now. I last I read, there's two. One gal had to be treated for an hour and then left and was fine. The other had to be kept in the hospital overnight, but was fine. The downside of actually getting the disease has so many side effects. And we've discussed this in past shows that 78% of people 3 months after having COVID, even mild to moderate symptoms, have cardiac abnormalities. And so it's not like, man, 2 or 3%, it's 78% had some cardiac abnormalities 3 months later. How significant this is, I don't know if there's severe cardiac abnormalities, but we know that some people have even needed transplants after having this disease. You kind of brought up this article about psychosis in patients. That is people who have had COVID. There was one study that showed that 18% of people had a diagnosable psychiatric disease after having COVID, which is pretty scary to me, that 1 in 5 people have anxiety, depression, or overt psychosis who had no diagnosable psychiatric illness before that. My hope is these all clear up and they heal. I don't know. We've had this discussion before. It reminds me an awful lot of chronic traumatic encephalopathy among football players, where there's little tiny places of damage in people's brains from, in this case, hard blows on the football field, and people who are in their 40s and 50s having anxiety, depression, early onset Alzheimer's, early onset Parkinson's disease. It sounds very similar. And what we're finding with COVID is that we're having a lot of clotting issues, which could be throwing off microemboli, meaning little tiny fragments of clotted blood that's going all over the brain and not causing a serious stroke where, man, I can't use my arm now, but causing little tiny spots of damage in the brain that could be leading to this psychosis, this anxiety, this depression. In the long run, damage to the heart and lungs could be leading to the long COVID that people, I just talked to somebody who had it in June and says, I still am short of breath. This was like 2 weeks ago I talked to her. She's like, I'm still short of breath and I still have daily headaches where I never had headaches before. So when I look at the safety of the vaccine as compared to getting the disease itself, with no reservations whatsoever, I'm going to get the vaccine and take my chances with that, because there's a chance that you're going to walk away from having COVID with something long-term. I hope you don't. And I hope all these clear up. That's my hope, is your body is able to clear this all up. That, you know, blood clots dissolve and brain returns to normal function. The 78% of people who have cardiac abnormalities, their heart, we don't think the heart heals that much, but it does. It does heal and gets back to normal, and these symptoms slowly disappear. But I don't know if they will. I can't promise anyone they will. Hopefully we come up with better treatments than we have right now for the long COVID that some people are experiencing. But right now it's not on the radar. So we'll continue to watch for it, though.
Kind of a follow-up to this, we have a question from a listener who said, there's a person walking down the trail, meets somebody who doesn't believe in the virus. What's the best spiel they can use to help convince them that it's real? I know you want to take this, even.
To be honest, I really haven't found a lot of success with arguing with people. I just try to be encouraging with people, shaming people, beating them up over their beliefs tends to entrench people into their beliefs more and more. And so I try to just be as encouraging as possible. I have numerous patients who still don't believe that this virus is a problem or that it exists, even though I can personally say I've had friends who were my age who dropped dead from this. And it's a sad deal. It's a sad deal. And to see people die 30 years before they should have from something that we may have been able to prevent just being by being a little bit more careful. And to be honest, one of my friends who died was a person who didn't believe in wearing masks. And so it's just one of those deals that I think beating people up isn't going to be help. I'm all about serving others where they're at and helping them along to a better spot. And it's a slow process, but I've just never been able to shame people into doing the right thing. That's why I don't even have like a Facebook account, because there's so much shaming of other people on like Say What You Want Kodiak and stuff like that, that I don't think it's helpful. And I think it actually causes people to dig into false beliefs more than coming alongside them and trying to help understand where they're coming from and just help guide them along through the process. And I'll continue to do that. I'll stick with what I believe is true. I'm not going to change my beliefs to make them more comfortable, but I'm not going to shame them for theirs either, because you know I'm wrong on a lot of stuff, but I'm trying my best.
And Shanna, you're a survivor. I mean, how would you convince somebody that it's real?
I completely agree with everything Dr. Jones said. I mean, I have had these conversations with people and tried to present, you know, the scientific evidence, the most, you know, pertinent, salient information. And I agree. I don't think you can necessarily convince people who have decided what they're going to believe about it and are getting information from, you know, who knows what sources. And you can try to look at those sources and try to, you know, debunk them, but none of that really is, it's someone's word against another person's word in their minds, I think. I do wish that people could see, to bear witness to, you know, some of the ICUs now in California and kind of in New York and Italy, and really just go in and see what's going on and what the healthcare providers are going through. I think seeing, you know, could be believing, but there's no way to have everyone who doesn't believe in that do that. And even when you show the news or show the documentation, there's still, you know, all number of kind of arguments why it's still not that bad or still not what it's cracked up to be. So I agree. I think in my opinion or in my experience, it hasn't been the best use of my time to try to convince people. I put as much information as I can out, and I'm responsible for my life and myself and what I do. And that's really all I have control over.
Yeah. It's going to be kind of a setback though, isn't it? If our ultimate goal here in regards to the virus is to get enough global vaccinations going, if 50% of the population doesn't want to get the vaccine, where does that leave us for the long game?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think as time goes on more, I mean, there's a lot of people in the middle. I think the stats I saw were about 40 to 50% said they would get it. 30 or so percent were kind of undecided, and around 30% were absolutely not going to get it. 20 to 30%. I don't know the exact numbers. These are kind of just based on surveys. But I think as time goes on, you know, and people get to see that this vaccine is similar to all the other vaccines and potentially safer. I mean, it only has very few ingredients. That's the fat membrane that it's in, the RNA material, salts and sugars. It's a really, there's, you know, no heavy metals, no chemicals, no preservatives that are toxic to the system. So I think as time goes on, people will be more convinced that there is really no significant problem with the vaccine. Dr. Osterholm, you know, really drove this point home. You're going to have bad things that happen after the vaccine. And if you compare across the population, those bad things are going to happen to people no matter what. People are still going to have heart attacks. They're still going to have, you know, allergic reactions or whatever. If that happens immediately following a vaccine and it's somebody who already has questions about it, they're going to attribute that to the vaccine. And it's really important for people to kind of know and really look at the data. Is that different than people who didn't get the vaccine? For example, AstraZeneca, in their trial, they had one person who died. The person who died was in the control arm of the trial. So they received a saline injection and died during the trial. And you know, if that had happened to a person that had actually received the vaccine, it would have been attributed to that. So it's really important to kind of bear all of the information in mind when you're looking at, you know, the stories that pop up in the media and on social networks. The vaccine is so far, I think, as far as we know, tremendously safe, and I would absolutely get it. And I encourage everybody to get the vaccine when it's your turn.
Have we had this problem historically with people not wanting to get vaccines? Has the numbers seemingly increased? I mean, it didn't seem like it was such a big deal to get a TB shot or a polio shot when you were a kid.
It's really interesting because there are, I'm going to generalize at this point, a lot of liberal kind of hippie types. You don't want any vaccines at all. And now with this vaccine type, now we have a lot of super conservative people are like, no way I'm getting that vaccine. It's a mix of the people. And I think people do have questions, and they have a right to really think about it and decide for themselves what they want, because they don't know the information. That's why I think shows like this are great, because we can kind of show that, yep, we're talking about how this is new, but it's not that new. It's actually really old technology, not really old, but relatively old technology. And so I think it's good for patients to question. I think it's good for patients to be concerned. In this case, I've looked into it very carefully. And I've looked into the disease very carefully and found that the vaccine, the odds of having a poor outcome from the vaccine are so underwhelming compared to the disease that I have no issue with taking the vaccine whatsoever. It didn't even bother me a bit to go in. I wasn't the least bit worried to go in and take the vaccine. But I think people do have a right to be questioning about it. And I'm hoping as we get good information out there that more and more people are more willing to take the vaccine. My big thing that I challenge everybody with is, I tease, I know, but the guy who lives in his mother's basement and puts things on the internet is not equal to a scientist at CDC to me. And some people want to give them equal weighting, even if he's a super smart guy living in his mother's basement. I don't think it's on the same footing as a lot of our top scientists in the U.S. We have gotten into such a conspiracy mindset in the U.S., though, that you don't know who to trust. And I got to be honest, there's times where I hear some news story and I have to look at three or four different sources because I don't trust some of them that I would have trusted in the past. So I get where people are coming from. I personally have looked into this and looked at original sources. I feel like this is a safe vaccine. Can I tell you what's going to happen to people 10 years out after getting this vaccine? No, I can't. I can tell you what happens to a lot of people 3 months after getting the disease, though. And for some people, they have some pretty poor outcomes. The vast majority of people do fine. After 3 months, they feel fine. But there's a fairly large percentage of people who are at work every day, but they feel lousy. And so I worry about that. And so I'm going to continue to be a proponent of this vaccine and continue to say that the disease is far worse than the vaccine.
We're going to close with two questions in regard to the vaccine here, too. One is, how can we expedite it? How can we expedite the vaccine? Can people volunteer to get trained to assist? I know that there's some questions about, you know, do we have the staff and the available people ready to actually deliver these vaccines when they're here? So I guess somebody wants to know if there's job opportunities in the vaccine business.
I think that we're probably going to have, I mean, certainly there's always going to be job opportunities because there is a higher demand, especially on MAs and nurses right now. One of my nurses who typically works with me got pulled off this to work on vaccines. So another person who's working with me is absolutely swamped. But the bigger issue is actually getting the vaccines themselves and getting enough of them. The actually giving the vaccine, time consuming, because now we have you wait 30 to 45 minutes after getting the vaccine to make sure that you don't have a reaction to it. So it is a little time consuming. It's not the old immunizations where you got shot and then you headed out the door. The new one, with this one, we're having you wait there to make sure you don't have a significant reaction. So it is a little more labor intensive, but the biggest, the narrow point of the stream of getting vaccines out there right now is just getting enough vaccines.
Is there something you have to do in the clinic specially, though, to deliver the vaccine to somebody? I mean, does it take, is it somewhat, is it anyhow different than going in to get a regular shot? I mean, you set the office up differently. I've seen pictures on the TV with people with full PPE on with a screen coming down with the person's arm sticking through a hole, you know, and it, is that how we're really delivering it?
I don't think we've gone that extreme here, but we do have people who are coming in just for this vaccine, and that's it. And frankly, we're calling our patients, and we're starting with people who have the most comorbidities, who are older, and we're working our way down in a priority fashion and calling patients, asking if they want it. One of my buddies is doing a lot of the calling, and he says it's pretty laborious because all of them want to talk to their doctor first. So I can say to all my patients, unless you have severe allergic reactions to things, then give me a call. Otherwise, get the vaccine.
Great. Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I think people still wear PPE because someone could be infected. You read the story about the nurse who got COVID 6 days after getting the vaccine. The possibilities are that she had already been kind of incubating the virus, and then it kind of showed itself after she got the vaccine, or she could have been exposed to it after the vaccine, but it takes about 14 days for that immune kind of system immunity to take effect. So her immune system just could have not been, you know, revved up after the vaccine. I think people still wear PPE, but it's not because the vaccine itself is dangerous. And you have about, I think, 5 days after you take it out of the deep cold freezer to administer it to people. So I think my understanding is Anchorage is sending them out of the deep cold freezer. We have that period of time to vaccinate the healthcare providers that are really at the front line and the higher risk, you know, elderly patients. And then the next tiers will be kind of the less elderly patients and not quite as frontline providers. It is underway. I hope it can speed up. We're going pretty slow at this point compared to where we wanted to be, but it is underway, which is kind of a miracle.
Yeah. So for your recommendation then to people who come in for the first shot is don't put your cape and your goggles on and for a couple more weeks until you get the next one, right? I mean, they still have to protect themselves from acquiring COVID after they've got the first vaccination.
Yeah. The immunity doesn't really take effect till after the second vaccine, the full immunity, you know, the 95%. And then 2 weeks after the vaccine is when your immune system kind of really ramps up the full antibody response.
2 weeks after the second one?
So it takes a couple weeks. Yeah, that's when it's really active, is 2 weeks after the second one. You get some immune response after the first one, probably closer to 50% protection after the 2 weeks after the first one. And then to get up to that 95%, you got to have the second one and another 2 weeks after that.
What's a 95% thing mean? It means there's still, even after you get two, you have a 5% chance of still getting it?
It is possible. Yeah.
In the clinical trials, 5% of the people that were vaccinated did get COVID, but again, their symptoms were much less. They were very mild compared to people who got COVID in the placebo group. So there still appears to be some protective immunity, even though people can still get infected. And again, this is very similar to the polio vaccine, to other vaccines that we have. None of them are 100% effective, but they can... Yeah, you know, the immunity that they provide is significantly better than not having anything at all.
And to be really clear about how they arrived at that number, it's not 5% of the people who got vaccinated still got COVID. It was at a rate of 5% compared to the placebo group. And so if they vaccinated, you know, 100 people, it doesn't mean 5 of the people who were vaccinated got it. It means that they got it at 5% the rate as the placebo group, to be really clear on that.
Oh, gotcha. So the
there's a good graph that shows that.
Where's the graph?
There is a website. If you look at vaccine comparisons, it will show you exactly the numbers of who got vaccinated and then who got the infection between the Pfizer and the Moderna. I can get you the actual link. There's two other quick resources. There's a Facebook support group for COVID long haulers. And there's a lot of really, I mean, I think if you are having symptoms after getting the virus, it's nice to know you're not alone. And it's really interesting to see kind of what people are going through several months after they got the vaccine, or sorry, after they got the infection. And then there is a virus or a vaccine adverse effect comparison chart that people can look and kind of track what's going on with the vaccines and who's getting what side effects as time goes on. So I think those are really useful for people.
Well, send them to me and I will put them on our website so people can link to them. That sounds interesting. The final question comes from somebody who wants to know about old people, where old people are in terms of in line for the vaccine. And is there a plan in the community to get old people vaccinated?
So with our system, we are sorting out by age. We're looking at people 65 or older to begin with. And we're starting with people with multiple comorbidities, meaning heart disease, cancer, things like that, that make them more vulnerable, starting with the older, most vulnerable people and calling them up and working our way down the list. If you are 20 years old and healthy, you're near the bottom of the list. It's going to be a while till we get to somebody like you. But people who are 75 and have had cancer and have high blood pressure and are obese, they're going to be closer to the top of the list. And so we are working through it in a stepwise fashion. And we are actually calling people about it. And we have begun immunizing people.
So that's your current client base. What if, so everybody is kind of on their own and then dependent upon whether or not how much availability of vaccine is to them, right? As a whole community, we can't look at the population base and say, because what I mean is, how do you identify the people that aren't associated with one of the clinics if they're just walk-in people who just go to the hospital?
Yeah, I'd recommend they get established with some clinic. At this point, and it's realistically, you should be established with some clinic somewhere, no matter how healthy or unhealthy you are, just so that you have a place to, if you have a health issue, that knows you. And I would recommend that with the immunization, that you get established. If you're new to town, KCHE, Canna, Kayak, they're all good places. And get established with one of them so you can be in line to get the immunization when your turn comes up. If you're not established anywhere, I'm sure it'll be available at some point through other venues. But right now, it is distributed through the clinics.
So the word is that eventually it's going to be something you're going to be able to go into your local Walgreens, Walmart, Safeway, and just pick up at the pharmacy and get a shot. But that's not anywhere in the distant in the near future for us, right?
That's probably six to 9 months out at the earliest.
Yeah, especially with the allergic reactions. They need to be near, someone who can provide higher level care and an EpiPen if needed.
So that changes the whole protocol for going in and getting a shot at Safeway, right?
They're being extra careful with this one because we have had some allergic reactions. And I think the reason they're being so careful, so nervous about it to begin with, that they're trying to keep the side effects down to a minimum. So it's in a very controlled environments.
Well, there's another hour and a half of your time that I thank you for. Really interesting show. We still have a ton of things to talk about. So as we move into a new year, we have many things to talk about, and I'm sure we'll have some more that'll come up in the next week. Hope we all make it through into 2021 and it's a better year. So
I am very positive that 2021 is going to be a great year. So happy new year.
Yes, happy new year.
Hey, thank you very much again for your time. You guys have a good week. Happy New Year.
Take care.
All right.